This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Rishi K. Sherway.
And I'm Joshua Molina. We're here today to discuss Season 1, Episode 10 of the series, In Excelsis Deo. It first aired on December 15th, 1999. It was written by Aaron Sorkin and Rick Cleveland and directed by Alex Graves.
Here's the synopsis from NBC. As Christmas Eve approaches, President Bartlett eagerly sneaks out of the White House for some last-minute Christmas shopping, while haunted Toby learns more about a forgotten Korean war hero who died alone on the district's cold streets, wearing a coat that Toby once donated to charity. In other hushed quarters, Sam and Josh ignore Leo's advice and consult Sam's call girl friend concerning her confidential clientele when one political rival hints at exposing Leo's previous drug problem. CJ wonders aloud about the president's public response to a notorious hate crime, while her personal resolve weakens as a persistent reporter continues to ask her out. And today we're joined by Richard Schiff.
Huzzah!
Hello. Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Before we start talking about the actual episode, could we ask you some background questions?
Sure.
How did you get the role of Toby Ziegler?
I slept with a lot of people. No, I auditioned like many other people. You did not have to, as I recall.
That's correct.
You bribed Aaron to put you on the show.
I Heimlicked him years earlier.
Once we became irrelevant, it was like it didn't matter if Josh Molina was on our show.
Yes, and if we're going to jump straight ahead, one of the most memorable quotes I remember from you was not long into my tenure on the show, uh-oh, you turned to me and you said, "We used to get awards." Before you joined the show.
Yeah, well, you know, you gotta keep going until you just drop off the cliff, and you kind of pushed us to the edge.
I'm the cooler.
No, we were very happy when you joined the cast.
Don't buy it back. How'd you get the job?
How did I get the job? I auditioned, and it's kind of a long story, and I'm kind of, you know, I had been given test deals for a lot of shows the year before, like four different shows, and I wasn't showing up to the test deal because I realized I don't want to do this show. And so the West Wing camp, you know, I was very tortured about it because you audition and you try to get stuff, and then I wanted to do movies. So this came along. I think it was Tommy Schlamme who wanted to see me, and we had worked a couple of times before. And I came in and auditioned, and I kind of knew, A, this was great material. B, it would last for two terms of a presidency. I think I'm the only one that actually said that out loud back then. And C, I have a good chance of getting it because I knew this guy or thought I did. So I went and auditioned for the first round, but I was also supposed to possibly do a movie by the German director whose name just popped out of my head.
Wim Wenders.
Wim Wenders had said, you know, Steve Buscemi might be dropping out of this, and if he doesn't, you're my new favorite actor. I want you to do this role. And sure enough, he dropped out right as the process of The West Wing was happening, and I wanted to do movies. And I was asked by my representatives, you know, so this conflicts with the movie, the pilot directly, which one do you want to do? And I said, the movie. I mean, NBC will never hire me anyway. It's not, and I want to do movies. Well, then the movie fell out, and he wanted me to come back and audition, and I was very upset by that and was given to somebody else. And I went to the West Wing process, and Bradley Whitford was there the second time I auditioned for the Warner Brothers studio thing. You have to audition first for the guys, and then the studio, and Tommy said, this is just a formality, and then you go and test for NBC, which I've done before. It's just this little room, and everybody's stacked up behind a desk. It's very unnatural and odd.
Horrible.
It was weird to see Brad. I've known Brad since he was in college because he was my brother's roommate. He and my brother took care of my dog for 6 months, so I was forever indebted to Brad for that. I got him his first audition in New York. I was a director back then. He'd always call me for advice. So I've known him forever. And I walk in and there he is and he's playing Josh. And I just started giggling. It was so weird.
He wasn't there to test. He had already been cast.
I think he was already cast. Yeah. So that was awkward. And I hate auditioning. You hate auditioning.
It's the worst.
Everybody hates auditioning. And I get nervous sometimes and I just start giggling. So I got through it and I said, it's just formality. Let's just get through it. And Tommy says, and so I did it. And Brad's trying to be very helpful. And I walk out the door and Tommy walks me out. He goes, well, tomorrow's the test. And this was just formality. I hope to see you there. And I go, well, just so you know, I might not show up. And he says, yes, I've heard. And then I said, I might also, if I do show up, I'll be really, really bad. And he says, yes, I've heard that too. So he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, I hope you come. And it was said with such incredible love and respect for each other's insanity, if you will, that it kind of melted me. The first of many times Tommy was able to do that, kind of disarm all of my neuroses and psychoses. And then as I'm walking out, I saw Alice and Janney in the pool of actors waiting to audition. I said, if they're serious about her, then these guys really know what they're doing. And I got a little excited about it. So the next day I came in for the test and I was awful, really bad. So much so that I again started giggling and I went, I'm sorry, this really sucks and I'll do it again. And I did it.
Giggling, not something you would normally associate with Toby Ziegler.
Right. Yeah, right in the middle of a negotiation with the congressional leaders. I'm sorry, I've sucked today. Let me start again. I went, got through it and left and got the part. Years later, someone came up to me, an actor who I know and love, and said, you know, I was the other actor up for that part. And I said, I had no idea, you're kidding me. And he said, and I was sure that I got the part. And I went, why? And he said, because I put my ear to the door when you auditioned and I couldn't hear a word you said. So I'm saying, I've got this. And that actor was Eugene Levy.
Wow.
And can you imagine?
Different show, I think.
Totally. Well, I don't think it's a different show, but totally different Toby, obviously. But I think equally, I was going to say equally brilliant. Thank you very much.
You're absolutely right.
But equally fascinating in terms of what he would bring from the other side of the spectrum.
Right. Really. Well, it's a tribute to you. I can't imagine anyone else. It's such an indelible portrait. I can't imagine anyone else playing the role.
Yeah.
Well, now I can't either.
Yeah. So this episode,
yeah.
How well do you remember it?
I watched it.
Okay.
but with my eyes closed. It's very tough for me to watch myself. I don't enjoy it. And I have very good sense memory, if you will. And I remember the emotional aspects of everything that was happening at the moment. You know, what was happening with the work and what was happening personally. You know, you have to want to relive that, I think, to sit through it. But I turned on the Netflix thing, and then the West Wing came on, and I couldn't resist watching the pilot. Because I went, oh, you know, everyone talks about this pilot. So I watched it. It was pretty good. It was a pretty good pilot.
It really was.
You know, and that scene with John, lovely, wonderful, rest in peace, John Spencer, that opening sequence, just walking through and just establishing the world, this crazy busy world, and specifically Leo as a character and running it to CJ and running it to Josh and running, was awesome. And establishing who Josh was and Toby was through that Christian Wright sequence. And it was just, it's just kind of brilliant writing, I have to say. I mean, there was this guy Sorkin. Oh, and then, yes, I did watch this episode and remembered it very vividly. I didn't need to rewatch it because I remember everything about it. Yeah.
What do you remember reading it originally? Did you know this is a special?
Well, that's another story. It was when I read it, and all due respect to the people who initially wrote it, but this was the first episode that we read that Aaron didn't write before Aaron got a chance to kind of okay it. And part of the reason was to speed our process along. And we did a read-through of it, and I was very upset by it. Honestly, and I remember we read it, and we got into a van. We were driven in a van from the set to the other side of the lot where the writers were. And I remember it was very quiet, I guess because I must have been emanating a a somewhat tense creating aura or something. And Allison broke the ice by saying, this is a really good episode for you. And I just kind of went off. I was so upset at the original story as written.
What was it? What was it that
and
set you off?
And it's all due respect. Rick Cleveland, it was his story. And it actually happened to his father, I think. And it's a lovely story, and I don't mean to disrespect that at all. But it was written from the opposite perspective of who Toby was. It was written about someone who was reluctant to participate. The police kind of had to drag him over to the site, and he was cracking jokes and that kind of stuff. And it was polar opposite. Now, I know that Toby was a little coarse right from the get-go, and a little harsh maybe in his opinions, and not the most open person in the world. But I thought I was creating a character that felt things very, very deeply and who cared extraordinarily about things. And so this didn't make any sense, and I was offended by it, to be honest. And anyway, Tommy came over to the trailers. We were by the cafeteria at Warner Brothers at that time. We were up those stages up there. And he said, I hear you're upset. And he's nodding his head like, we're going to talk. It's okay. And I started crying. I couldn't. See, this stuff comes back when I talk about it and when I look at it. I was really upset. And he goes, listen, we're going to work on it. It's going to be fine. It's just, it's written. We get it. Blah, blah, blah. And he calmed me down a little bit. 20 minutes later, Aaron shows up. As soon as I see him, I start crying. Again, and he says, "We're going to fix this. We're going to blah blah blah." And years later, and I don't know if I'm talking out of school, but I think Tommy mentioned to me that originally, I don't think this disrespects anybody by saying it. It was written for Sam. It was written for what's his name?
Rob Lowe.
No, that's not it. Yeah, it's Rob Lowe.
Janelle had the same problem. We're going to address this in some sort of group therapy session down the line.
And for Sam, I guess, who was a little bit more glib and a little bit more, maybe that disposition made sense. And Rick had not had a time to readjust for my character. I don't know. I think it was Tommy who said, this has got to be Toby. This has got to be Toby. And we went and collaborated, you know, mostly Aaron, who I think loved my character and loved what I was doing with it and got it. And I always thought that, you know, with all of the beautiful language of Aaron Sorkin and all of the flowing kind of wonderful language, that he had tendrils, is that the right word, underneath the soil, roots, that's what I was digging for. I was looking for what's that mushroom that the...
Truffles.
I was looking for the...
Chatting with you is fun. It's like a quiz show.
I was looking for stuff underneath. And I think he recognized that. And then he wrote something very simple. It's really only four or five scenes this episode that I'm in. But that was from the correct perspective, I think. And, you know, that's how it evolved into becoming, I think, one of fans' favorite episodes. It doesn't just come out of someone's brain and then it's brilliant. I mean, these things have to happen where someone's has a visceral reaction to something that might not be right, and then people go, well, he's, you know, that makes sense, and then adjust it, and then it's better than you could have even imagined it would have been from the beginning.
So that speaks to a question we discussed earlier about collaboration and give and take. And I'm on the other end of the spectrum where in 4 years on the show, I never had an idea or feedback.
Wasn't that just your character?
Well, I'd like to think so. It's also, I remember Brad once characterizing my acting as a single layer cake. And yours is considerably deeper and better and richer. This is a great specific story. Would you regularly...
First of all, I think he was great on the show. I can't say it to his face. I'm saying it to you.
That's fine. I'll
take it. Talking about Brad or me?
He's talking about you. Okay.
All right, but would you frequently... After a table read, say, I think you got this right.
Yes.
I think
always. And it's
throughout.
A reputation I have that doesn't scare smart people and scares the daylights out of hacks. Yeah. I'm saying that with a little facetious thing. I think people are a little nervous about people who have opinions and are willing to stand up for them. I'm much mellower than I was back then in terms of I understand things better, so I don't get so viscerally upset, and I realize there's something we can do about it. But yeah, I have opinions, and it probably comes from the years of directing theater back in New York, or it's just the way my brain works. I kind of work backwards. I kind of see what it is going to be, and then I fill in how you get there. And I did that a lot, and Tommy and I would get into real healthy fights. And at one point, I thought later on, I think in year two, it was like, I think I got to stop doing this to myself. Because, you know, people started to like walk away whenever I was starting my reaction to a thing. And I went, I think I just better stop. And after about 2 weeks, I got a knock on my trailer. And it's Tommy. And Tommy comes in and says, are you all right? I went, yeah, why? He goes, why aren't you fighting with me? I miss our fights. He goes, I learn more about what we do and what we're doing by you challenging me. If you stop, I am not going to be as good. He's a remarkable man, actually, and quite a phenomenal director. You can see what's happening in the human being that's creating the role. He does just, it's not a puppet show for him. And he realized that I was off, I wasn't doing what I do. And he was saying, I appreciate the way you work. You know, not everybody does, but he does. So there was a lot of that. And there was, you know, and I think I got the respect of Aaron and Tommy early on because I gave away stuff. I'd get a 3-page monologue and I would go to Aaron afterwards. I go, this is Josh. This isn't Toby's voice. And he would go, you're right. And then Josh, you know, Brad probably never knew this, but he, all those long monologues that, you know, was a pain in the ass for him to learn. A lot of them were written, you know, at times for me here and there. Another, you know, other things that I thought, this is Leo, this is... And so when I went to him and said, I think this is Toby, they listened. They knew it wasn't an actor who just wanted to speak more words. I really wanted to... First, and I also wanted Toby to not speak unless it was necessary. I thought he was someone who was formulating and ruminating and gurgling like a volcano, you know what I mean, until he had to speak and he had to say something. And so arbitrary stuff, I thought, wasn't right either.
It's amazing how much that dynamic that you're describing between you and Tommy feels like a reflection of Toby and the president in the show.
Well, very much so. And that's a good point. And Aaron is brilliant, not just because he's got a really encyclopedic brain and an ear for music and for language, but he reacts to the living world of creativity on the set. Mm-hmm. And he sees who these people are that are creating these characters. And he will do anything for an idea. So he's a smart, very smart writer, television writer, to go, wow. You remember Day for Night, the movie Day for Night, Truffaut? About the making of making a film in France, and the actress had a drama, and she went up to him, and she was very upset because her boyfriend this, and I think her boyfriend was the other leading actor, and she spends 20 minutes, and you see the director. He's nodding and nodding and listening and nodding, and cut, and the next day, they're getting ready for a scene, and they've got their rewrites, and the actress is reading the new lines, and it's verbatim exactly what she was saying in real life to the director the day before. Well, that's a great writer. A great writer will just take what's ever in front of him. And I think Aaron saw that quality in me and
synthesized it into the character.
Writing a beautiful storyline, yeah.
Even the gesture that you described, Tommy putting his hand on your shoulder, there's a moment in this episode that I love at the end when you have a scene with the president and he puts his hand on your shoulder.
That's right.
Toby, if we start pulling strings like this, you don't think every homeless veteran will come out of the woodwork?
I can only hope, sir.
When is this thing?
I'm going to pick up his brother and go there now.
Mr. President? Sir, your absence in the other room is conspicuous.
Okay.
It's quite a powerful moment in many ways because he's not only saying, it's okay that you did this. He's saying that is the very core of what we do. We do not give in to the parameters of etiquette and social restrictions. We do what we have to do in our gut, and that's who we are. And that was quite a, I remember that scene very well.
Mm-hmm. I felt like that was kind of a theme for this episode, the lines that the characters are willing to cross out of loyalty. And they're sort of explored in these right. two different ways. One is in this...
Leo and Josh have the exact same moment, right. really, just without the hand on the shoulder.
We meant well.
Is that supposed to mean something to me?
No.
It does.
I'm glad.
Even though what he did was really not the right thing, it does break the sort of compact that they have with the world at large. Josh keeps getting told...
It's not what we do.
The idea of going to Laurie and trying to mine... her for information, yeah.
Yeah. Even though his base instincts are out of loyalty again, that's an example of him willing to cross the line in a way that isn't okay. Right. I love that there's that kind of balance.
Right, but episode. Leo knew that that's who he was.
Right.
That's why he had him tailed.
Yeah.
And in the end says, I'm glad you did. Meaning, I'm glad that's who you are. That's who I want watching my back or at my side.
Mm-hmm. When you guys were shooting this, a bunch of this is on location. You're in Arlington.
This easily could have been shot weeks apart.
Yeah. That's what I was wondering. If that 8 or 9 days happens, like you shoot for 5 days on the lot and then you go to D.C. and you shoot.
Well, you go to D.C. and you shoot, you know, we only went 4 times a year. So we would shoot 3 or 4 episodes worth of exteriors.
Huh.
So I don't remember the timeline of our shooting schedule. I know we had to get it done before Christmas because it was a Christmas episode, but it was still warm. I remember thinking, because it was playing for Christmas,
right.
which mm-hmm. is cold in D.C. I remember asking Tommy, what are you doing about all the green leaves? And he goes, you know what? No one's going to notice.
My wife noticed.
Really?
She's like, isn't it supposed to be Christmas time? And I was like, Washington, D.C. is
kind of warm. It was unseasonably warm.
Right, so yeah. We probably shot it we started in July, so we probably shot it in September, early
September. Having scenes at the Korean War Memorial, that was powerful.
Incredible, yeah. That's one where the location really just increases the
Well, I'll tell you what, first of all, we weren't allowed to shoot on the memorial. That was a stolen shot.
That's oh, is that right? Really? Little guerrilla filmmaking?
Now that I've said that out loud... We're all under arrest. there's a lot of guerrilla filmmaking. We were jumping around, stealing shots. You're not allowed to shoot on the memorials. But I remember pacing around before the scene, and was the actor's name Tom Quinn, or the actor who was in the kiosk. Do you remember mm-hmm. that scene?
Plays Noonan.
Mm-hmm. Tom Quinn, yeah, you're right.
Is it Tom Quinn? I loved that actor. Mm-hmm. I absolutely loved him. I'm going to get it.
Cry.
You're getting choked up. That exchange is really beautiful. You know, you were talking about the way that Toby was represented originally in the first draft as being maybe too abrasive. I loved in the final product how much it kind of pulled between the Toby that we knew, the sort of very right. prickly person, and even in the beginning of the episode, bah humbugging the whole Christmas pageantry. And then in this moment, in that exchange with John Noonan, at the end, Toby volunteers.
Merry Christmas.
And it's a reversal from that beginning, and it's right. even a reversal from the scene with Lance Reddick, where I think he wishes a Merry Christmas and feels like, you know, you're kind of taken off guard by that.
This guy was in Korea.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Merry Christmas.
Well, there's a number of things in my mind. Let's go from the kiosk and then talk about Lance. But that scene, I remember walking around, pacing around, and I had this incredible emotional reaction to this story at this point, and it was hard to contain. And that's what I was working on. I was trying to keep a lid on it. As you can see, the memory of it is bringing up emotions now, even. And I was walking around in the Korean You're just going to let there be silence now.
Yeah. No, I'm curious. Is it the memory of it?
It's a memory of it. Well, it's the emotion is coming right back, which I was able to contain on the day. Just walking around the memorial was really powerful for me.
You want to take a second?
It is what it is.
It's and, beautiful.
The relationship that I created for Toby to have with veterans, it almost appears that Toby was a veteran because mm-hmm. he recognizes the tattoo. But he was also clearly someone who protested the war against Vietnam. But I remember being young and being a protester against the war. And at that time in the Vietnam War, there was a vitriolic reaction to when protesters saw military. And I always had the opposite. I always had the opposite reaction to them, and I always made a point to talking to them. And if I had the words, I would have said, thank you for your service.
That's one of the things I loved about that scene with Noonan, because you don't say those specific words, but it's clearly what you're saying.
That Merry Christmas is clearly thank you for your service. Exactly right. And Tom was a veteran. I asked him. And you could see it in his face that he was. You can see his whole history and relationship, and that kiosk is real. That kiosk was raising money for veterans, something related to the VA. I don't know what specific, but people come, you sign the name, you ask me to sign the thing, and he blew me away. He blew me away with such simplicity and such depth that he had just in his face, you know? So that was a tough scene to do, and I remember pacing around, and Tommy, God bless him, punched Alex in the shoulder. I saw this peripherally and went, shoot, shoot, shoot. Richard's ready, shoot. Are you not ready yet? Shoot, shoot, shoot. You know, he saw me pacing and pacing and pacing. Yeah, that was, you know, you had to carry that around all day, you know, and so it was tough to contain sometimes. And then the scene with Lance, it was very tricky for me to all these factors were playing. What the hell am I doing here? There's a dead man on the bench. And this cop who seems to not give a f-. I don't know if this was premeditated or discovered in the moment, but Lance played it beautifully as a cop who was just doing his job. And then Toby notices, he says,
listen, this isn't a crime scene, is it?
No, sir.
So I got the call an hour ago. I went to the coroner's office. I'm just wondering why the body's still here.
An ambulance will come by. It's not a high priority.
And then you're going to call the VA, right?
The VA?
To me, it was, this is a veteran. This is a man, firstly, and a veteran, secondly, and you're not showing respect. But the confusion of it all had to play throughout that scene as well. Like, you know, what is this? And I remember just giving Lance like two or three looks, like, you know, what's
It's all in the silences in that first scene, in your face.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And anyway, Lance was great in that scene.
One thing I noticed in this episode was your shoulders. It felt like you're making big moves. I don't know. I was getting a lot from
body language.
Yeah, from the body language. And just there are a few shrugs in the episode that I felt like I was seeing it with a different eye and catching new things.
Well, a couple of things I think were affecting the one, he was around real men, I think, in his mind. You know, he was on the street. He was on a dangerous part of the war, you know, when he was going looking for, what was his name?
George Hufnagel.
Hufnagel. And in the street under the roadway there in the cold. And it was a heavy coat. And a lot of times, you know, you adjust the coat. But I think it was also something's wrong, you know, and it's like that boxer who... you know, or my grandfather used to do it. You know, he was a prize fighter and a gangster. It's like, if he sensed something was wrong, he would start twitching, you know. Things would happen to his body. So maybe that's where that came from.
On that note, let's take a quick break.
And now back to the show.
Josh has told me about how meticulously you would prepare on set.
The West Wing, as TV shows go, had a lot of rehearsal.
I mean, yes, and that was the culture that I think I helped create. I think John Spencer helped create.
Yeah, I suspect that's true. It was a little bit like working on a play, which is not the normal.
And there's two factors there. A, we were all theater people, and B, Aaron Sorkin's writing is playwriting, and it has depth, and it also has nomenclature we might not understand. It also has policy we might not totally get, and we need clarification. We also need to know how we feel about it, and that requires attention, and you can't just throw that crap against the wall and pray.
You guys would rehearse without cameras?
Oh, yeah.
Without cameras?
Yeah.
Nowadays, because it's digital, we started on film. You say, oh, yeah, you know, you want to shoot, you want to rehearse? I got, just shoot the rehearsal. But then, first of all, Tom Del Ruth was very particular about the lighting. We had the best cameraman in the world in
Rob Lowe.
Dave Chimaides, who was a dear friend and a wonderful man and one of the best Steadicam operators in the world at that time. So we had to work out our moves, A. We had to figure out where we were. And guest directors would often, because they want to save time and it's television and they often do this, come in and block it over the weekend for themselves. And I would walk in, you know, this is not Tommy and this is not Alex Graves, but the guest directors, especially the TV ones, would have the scene already blocked. And I'd walk in with our scripts in our hands and then we'd go, Richard, you go over there and me and I do, and then you cross over here. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? I cross where? You go over there and I go, you know, and I ask the cliche, like, why am I going over there? And then years later, I realized they've choreographed these shots and they want everyone. But I didn't particularly enjoy accommodating that for the sake of accommodating it.
From your point of view, they've skipped an incredibly vital part of your process.
Yeah, of all of our processes. Of all of our processes. I mean, he's including me in a group shot when emotionally, or even if you just look at the words, I am opposed to this, to the, you know what I mean? And my physical disposition might be to cross to the other side of the room and confront them, or to, you know, have one foot out the door, or be private and not let them know that I'm formulating a response that is going to upset the cart, you know? Mm-hmm. To dictate that without understanding, you know, without caring what the impulses of the actors are, I found difficult. So we got into a culture of rehearsing for us and then rehearsing for camera. Mm-hmm. And directors were able to adjust quite easily. And it saves time. That's what people don't get. And when I say people, I mean people in the business and, you know, the producers and directors of these other TV shows. They don't get that if everything is worked out, then you don't have the gears grinding into each other 3 hours from now because something doesn't make sense. You know what I mean?
You talked earlier about containing emotion, and I think when you watch Toby, that there's always a lot bubbling underneath. He's dealing with on his own. And there's another piece of acting, and I feel like that's the perfect word in this episode, with Catherine Joosten. Mm. May she rest in peace.
Wasn't she amazing in this episode?
I've never seen a Christmas look like this. The trees and the lights and everybody singing.
Yeah.
The presents.
Yeah.
I brought it up because, I don't know, you seem a little down this week.
Yeah, I know, Charlie. I tend to get a little down during the holidays.
You don't like Christmas?
I miss my boys.
I never knew you had kids.
Twins. Andrew and Simon. I tried not to, you know, I dressed them differently. But they still did everything together. They went off to medical school together, and then they finished their second year, and of course, their lottery number came up at the same time.
For the draft?
Yeah.
Well, I would have thought they could get a deferment to finish med school.
They didn't want one. Their father and I begged them, but they wanted to go where people needed doctors. Their father and I begged them, but you can't tell kids anything. So they joined up as medics, and 4 months later, they were pinned down during a fight in Da Nang and were killed by enemy fire. That was Christmas Eve, 1970. You know, they were so young, Charlie. They were your age. It's hard when that happens so far away, you know, because with the noises and the shooting, they had to be so scared. It's hard not to think that right then they needed their mother. Anyway, I miss my boys.
Okay.
It's an incredible scene, during the entirety of which she's still working on her computer and
she keeps working.
And she works through it and she's
phenomenal.
It's exactly what she contains.
She cannot go there. And she knows it, but she's placating, if you will, or providing the story that he's curious mm-hmm. about.
And she can't even quite bring herself to look at him.
Right. And then she asks to go to the funeral. The one thing that bothered me in watching it again was that there was no time for it, I think. And all I did was kind of go.
But I got it there. What are you going to say? What did you feel was missing?
I don't know. But I just thought, because I had to assume that I knew the story.
Absolutely. But yeah. For me as a viewer, it was there. The same way, without saying, thank you for your service, you said it. You did it in your Toby way.
I just thought it was a tad quick. I just thought I would look at her and maybe remember the story because it was a little too convenient. Or maybe, I don't know if that's necessary or not, but that's a mini little thing.
Yeah, I completely got that you understood why she would want to go with you and that you made her welcome.
Well, that's a relief.
In episode 5, they introduce that idea in the These Women scene when they're the president and Leo are looking around at the staff, and the president says,
Mrs. Lanningham, did you guys know she lost 2 sons in Vietnam? What would make her want to serve her country is beyond me, but in 14 years, she's not missed a day's work, not one.
So the fact that she's actually literally at work while talking about that feels in some way like an answer to that.
Well, the great writers and the great storytellers earn every moment. Mm-hmm. And if you do not plant the seeds, then the reveal isn't impactful. And if anyone did that, all you got to do is look at Breaking Bad. And they plant seeds 3 years before the payoff.
Right.
And
long
that,
ball.
Someone said the other day, that was like a 5-year movie.
Right.
An ongoing novel. And Aaron does the same thing. He does not just go for, it'll be cool if she lost her 2 kids. He plants it.
Right.
And then it pays off. It's true of a lot of things.
Yeah. There's a lot of death in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Between Mrs. Lanningham's sons and Walter Huffnagel and...
The kid,
yeah. The kid who's modeled after Matthew Shepard.
Right, the gay teenager who was pelted to death, really.
Yeah.
And that really lovely moment that Martin Sheen has, lovely is not the right word, but powerful moment when he's told of his death.
I'm sorry to interrupt, sir, but you asked me to keep you posted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lowell Lydell died about 15 minutes ago. Okay.
Yeah, as he's just moments away been sort of entertaining a group of visiting kids.
Then he goes back to entertaining mm-hmm. them. He goes back, and it's one, I think, of a recurring theme of the West Wing, which is no matter what happens, you got to go back. You got to keep working. What's next is probably the most important line or tagline of the series, because no matter what, you got to keep going. You're still the president of the United States.
What's next? We've adopted that as our tagline at the end of every episode.
We're going to make you say it later.
So we're going to make you say it, yeah. We say, okay, what's next? And for me, that's part of the fabric of the show is the word okay. And I feel like this is the first episode where it really comes out. I think I counted, there were over 20 times that just the word okay is said between
the
characters in this episode.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was 24 times people say okay in this episode. Huh. And it's used in such a, every time it's said, there's a lot loaded into that one word, The president says it after learning about the death of the high school student.
Right.
And Charlie says it after Mrs. Lanningham.
Yeah, he says, okay. It's an odd moment, which is lovely. Lovely, I keep using that word. It's an appropriately awkward ending.
Right.
What do you say to that story? There's nothing to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The repetition of that.
God, I love that man. I just love Dulé Hill. I just love that man. And what was he, 24 when he got that
job? We were commenting on how young he looks this first season.
He looks so young. He's the only one that's aged.
He's a different person. That's right.
We all are fine.
Yeah, he looks terrible now.
He now looks like his grandfather. No, I'm kidding. He's still a very young buck, handsome man. But I was so impressed with him as a human being, just as a, you know, just the way he, what's the word?
Rob Lowe.
Anyway.
Speaking of your love for the cast, I last night rewatched your Emmy acceptance speech.
Hey, Brad. Hey. I just want all the cast members to come up here. I mean, I'm really happy that Allison won, so that I don't have to repeat everything that she said, but I will anyway. I really thought that I missed my era, and I should have been around in the time of O'Neill, you know, Eugene O'Neill and Clifford Odets and Arthur Miller, and who would have thought that every 8 days I get to do a new play written by a writer who combines the greatest attributes of all those writers and is the greatest writer of this era, Aaron Sorkin. Thank you, Aaron. Tommy Schlamme is the executive producer, and along with John Wells and many times director. And Tommy, thank you for encouraging us and allowing us and joining us in the impossible pursuit of excellence. Thank you. And the cast of The West Wing, who I love dearly, this obviously is for everybody. Come with me and celebrate. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about that. You won an Emmy for this
episode.
You're
getting giddy over this.
I am excited
now.
Just because I've had this conversation with you before. Do you have some regrets about that speech? Is
really?
That not correct?
Just
well, say what you were going to say first,
Richie. It's beautiful. I love that speech. And I love how un-Toby it is, certainly, you know, like that there's no kind of curmudgeonly, begrudging anything. You're just like full of love for your castmates. And that's really sweet.
I remember the speech because of what I omitted.
That's what I want to get to.
Ah, I see.
I remember because I went over it 1,000 times. Like, how can you do that? First of all, I did not enjoy the night.
Really?
Not in the least. And it's something I've come to grips with myself. And it's very hard to live here, which I don't want to be doing in Hollywood, and realize that you're someone who really doesn't want any attention. I really just don't want anyone to notice me. But I want them to notice that guy who does that work so I can get more work, you know? And I freak out when I get too much attention. My physiology rejects it. It's not in my control. And Allison won first the Emmy Award, and I literally said, I might win. And I had this speech, and Sheila was being great and wanted to, my wife, you know, make this about us and not make it a big deal. And, you know, we had fun on the red carpet, which was very unusual for me. And then my name got announced, and I remember doing this with my hand, and I go, now, what do I do? And I got up, and I ran to Aaron and Tommy and hugged them. I remember that. And then I was making my way to the stage, and all the West Wing actors were hugging me. And if it felt like, all right, it's been 30 minutes since my name's been called. They're going to start playing the music. And you know, and then I started speaking, and then my body said, I can't keep you here any longer. And my body—
You played yourself off.
My what?
You played yourself off.
I think
that music
my body
starting.
Provided the hook, which dragged me off the stage. And I literally, the physical sensation was of me spinning out of control in a spiral, in a gyro. And I just said, and I left. And then as I'm walking off stage, this woman says, congratulations. You know, one of the women with the dresses says, congratulations. And at that moment, I stopped and went, huh! And I realized I didn't thank my wife and my kids. Now, the opportunity, as someone who's funny, which is you, Josh Molina, I had so many opportunities to be hysterical. But I was too much in an existential panic. My daughter had been born 7 days earlier and was in the building in Whoopi Goldberg's dressing room. That's good material to open with. You know what I mean?
Better to draw a parallel between Aaron and Arthur Miller. How'd that go over with Sheila?
It was a tough night. Sheila's no easy little, you know, picadill. She's... Yeah. It was a tough night. First of all, I felt like my soul had left my body, or some betrayal in my own, you know, like I disappeared off the stage before my body did. And you know, people go up there and go, oh man, this is so surreal. Well, I experienced the ultimate surreal experience, which is I didn't exist anymore. It was a make-believe version of me up there.
Where's the Emmy?
It's in my office behind me, along with my baseball trophy from the 1988 New York City Softball Championships.
Nice.
And a bunch of other statues back there and stuff. No one ever sees it because no one goes into my goes into my office. But I Skype and every now and then with directors and, you know, meetings and stuff.
Do you place it?
Just power play.
W.H. Macy and I were talking on Skype recently. And he goes, well, I see your Emmys, you know, or my Emmy or whatever. And I realized that my computer faces behind me. And I got my 1961 New York Yankee little statue of all the guys.
You know, Baron,
Mickey Mantle. So.
Let's go Mets.
The Mets didn't exist in 61.
Neither did I.
That's up.
Well, if I had an Emmy, I'd attach it to my car keys.
You know, I'm a Yankee fan because my grandfather was a Dodger fan.
So was mine.
Well, Ebbets Field.
My dad grew up going to 40 games a year at Ebbets Field.
Well, my mother, my grandfather caught a ball by Duke Snyder that he gave to me that's now in a sewer in the Bronx. And there was no team except the Yankees. The Dodgers and Giants left in 57, 58. I was born in 55, which makes me 46 years old.
That's right.
And
checks out.
And so there was no team. So, and he was a baseball, he played minor league baseball, among many other things. So he took me, my first game was I saw Ted Williams last year, the Red Sox.
So I went the other way with my New York Jewish family. I was weaned on hatred of the Yankees.
Well, you either, it was one or the other.
Right. Janelle talked to us about a moment.
Yes.
That is in this episode.
With Josh.
And
with
so
Josh.
I watched it closely. With Josh, she said that Alex Graves was the first person as a director to make explicit how they felt about each other with a shot of Josh, I think, after he gives her the book.
Looking at her, she's smiling, reading the book.
Yeah. Right, and that's
just
where...
Just that peek out of his office door.
Yeah.
I wrote a note inside. No, don't get emotional. Donna, don't get... You know... Let's try and maintain some sort of...
You see, you spend most of your time being, you know, you. And then you write something like this to me. Wow. Thank you.
I meant it.
Skis would have killed you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tangent, did it bother anyone else that he bought her a rare book and then signed it? Wrote a whole scroll. It's like, dude, this is when you go to Hallmark, buy a $5 card and write your lovely sentiment
inside.
You know
what? I was having this conversation the other day with Kevin Pollak, of all people, about how nowadays, because people watch things 137 times, these little things.
Every little thing.
Every little thing. But in the old days, you know, Hitchcock used to have a philosophy, this is Kevin Pollak speaking, you know, that all they want to do is be entertained. You know, so all the little things, and Kevin Pollak is saying, you know, if you were going to kill a guy, you wouldn't decide a crop duster is the best way to do that.
Right.
But that's good what he point. Saw for the poster. So he had to have a scene with a crop duster trying to kill Cary Grant in the middle of a cornfield, which Kevin Pollak also points out. It was never explained what he was doing in the cornfield. And in those days, you just had to be exhilarated by the bomb under the seat, as Hitchcock would put it. And you just talked about how scared you were.
Right.
You didn't go, oh, come on, what was he doing in the cornfield?
Oh,
that actually, this really speaks to something that Rishi and I deal with a lot, which is we have fun sometimes with picking apart little things or little issues of credibility. And then the truth is, I'm sure if you brought it up to Aaron, I think he would say, I was trying to entertain for an hour. Does it matter whether Mr. Willis couldn't have been appointed to his seat as a congressman?
Right.
So, I mean, the truth
that
is,
does
I...
That does matter.
Well...
That matters.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I brought it up, but I can see it's two sides of the same coin.
He couldn't be the husband doesn't take over the seat?
No, it would had he would have had to have been elected special through election. A special, special election. Exactly.
You want to know a really cool moment from that
Absolutely.
Episode?
Yes.
This always made me laugh. I was experimenting. What year was that?
1999.
That was the first year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was experimenting already with the way I was, this character, and experimenting with neutrality, you know, based on the psychological study of seeing a neutral face and then seeing a picture of a murder and then seeing that face again and then seeing the same face and then seeing a picture of two people in love and then seeing that face again, same face. And almost 99.999% of the time, people would associate something evil with the neutral face when they saw the murder or the crime scene, and something beautiful and serene or something with the face, same face.
Right.
So I was like, you know, I'm going to f*** around with this. So the very last scene, I think it was a poker table. We were at a poker table, and I get up, and I go, I just want to see the vote, because I had this whole experience with this Mr. Willis. And I'm looking at this screen and they don't have the picture, right? Because normally I would want the picture so that I can react to it. So I'm not going to decide what my reaction is going to be. So I'm literally going, I don't know what my reaction is going to be because I'm not going to have a reaction. I'm going to create one, which I'd rather not do. I'd rather have the reaction. So I'd rather have the pinch and I will go, ouch, you know, that's the Meisner way of putting it. And so there was just a green screen. So I'm just looking at it, and I'm going, I wonder what my reaction would be. And then I remembered this thing, and I just saw, I'm going to think about something else. And I'm just going to look at the screen and think about that. And I did it, and they wrapped. And Tommy very often, 2 days later, is when he comes up to you and goes, oh, my God, because he sees it in editing. He doesn't do it on the day because he's too busy going on to the next shot.
Right.
And sure enough, 2 or 3 days later, he running up to me. He goes, that was the most brilliant bit of nonverbal acting I've ever seen. It was phenomenal. We were all talking about it in the editing room. Blah, blah, blah. So I never told him what I was actually thinking.
That's hilarious.
He goes, it was the most brilliant, brilliant. You know what I was thinking?
What's for lunch?
Neutral face.
No. No. It wasn't so neutral. I was looking at the screen thinking, what would it be like to have sex with Allison Janney?
Oh, whoa. This is a bombshell. Bombshell.
And so I, so people so
now,
should,
is that
I,
what you always do now?
In every scene and in every character
that's what you're actually
that
thinking.
I play, that I want simplicity and my body to get quiet, I will think about having sex with
this
Allison.
This is revelatory. Yeah. When you did Lost World, did you insist on real dinosaurs, or would you?
I had real dinosaurs.
Were you willing to work with a green screen?
I know those were real. What was what were we talking about just now?
We were talking originally about Alex Graves making explicit the moment between Josh and Donna.
Well, that Alex Graves directed this. That's true.
Yeah. So, what was your experience?
Well, he became the producer when the last years of the West Wing.
He directed my first episode.
Yeah. Well, Alex is very, very talented. He was very confident with the camera and very effusive to the actors.
That's true.
He would walk on set wiping away a tear. I'm going, did we get it? And he would, am I crying? You know, that kind of thing. So effusive that you tend to dismiss his comments and you kind of look for another source to see if you actually did have an effect on someone. But very, very talented guy. But Tommy was always around for this episode. Tommy was still like overseeing everything, which I was happy about.
Yeah, well, you guys were still establishing what the show was and who the characters were.
But Alex really deserved at least a nomination for that. You know how beautifully it was edited? I think that's another thing Alex prides himself in is the final edit and that beautiful sequence at the end of this episode, going back and forth from the funeral to the kids singing Pa-rum-pum-pum-pum. What's the name of that song?
Little Drummer Boy.
Jewish.
Huh?
Little Drummer Boy.
There you
yeah,
go.
That one. Little Drummer Boy.
So why is it called In Excelsis Deo? Because Little Drummer Boy sounded like a lame name for an episode of television.
I believe the working title was A Christmas Episode in the original.
I don't remember.
Rick Cleveland draft. It was called A Christmas Episode.
In the original, not Toby Ziegler, or not Richard Schiff endorsed.
Right.
Yeah.
Rick Cleveland was at the time a great writer, a great playwright before that, and gone on to have a wonderful career.
For Mad Men and 6 Feet Under and all sorts of things.
And he and Aaron have an
interesting history that people can Google if they like. Since neither of them is here, we won't get too far into it, but they had an interesting history, I mean, with regards to this specific episode.
Really?
And the Emmy win for writing for this episode.
Well, I know Rick was upset, and I should have mentioned him as well as my wife, but my wife gets the first regret.
Right.
Rick's down
secondary
the list.
Secondary regret for Rick.
Yeah. Fair enough. And Aaron totally retooled the essence of it, you know. But it was Rick's
story
and he got it started, and you gotta give due. No matter what the final product is, somebody comes up with a great idea and gets it going, they deserve the credit for it.
I am curious about the title, though, because, I mean, In Excelsis Deo is part of a longer Latin phrase, Gloria in Excelsis Deo, glory to God in the highest.
It's a Christmas thing, isn't it?
I mean, it's part of a hymn.
Gloria
in Excelsis Deo.
Yeah, everybody knows except for me.
The New York Jew Choir.
It was also Lisa Edelstein, and how great was she, A, and B, what?
I'm a longtime fan of yours, pre-West Wing, and weren't you in Relativity?
She was my daughter.
Yes, I thought so. And
she played my lesbian daughter.
I loved that show. It was very short-lived, but it was very good.
It was really good.
It had a hell of a cast.
By the way, to this day, my favorite character.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
That character.
You want to say that on the West Wing Weekly.
Well, he was. I mean, I loved Toby, but I have a love-hate relationship with him. Barry was his name? Barry something Jewish?
Barry something Jewish.
Schwarzenbaumman, Flammen,
sure.
Goldenberg. It wasn't Barry Roth, was it?
Rob Lowe.
He knows that I'm going to laugh whenever he says name.
It's an easy laugh.
That's a defensive response.
Just trying to make you cry again.
To get considered for an Emmy, you have to pick episodes to send them, right?
Yeah.
So I think I read that this was one of two episodes that led to your Emmy win. Did you know while you were shooting it, did you know this was going to be like a big episode for you, or was it only after you saw the final edit?
No, neither. Huh. Tommy came up to me and said, "Do you have any idea how people are reacting to that show?" And I went, "No." I had no idea. I never looked at ratings. I never read reviews. I don't think, because, my reps would go, "Well, we have to do this Emmy thing." And I had no idea what that meant. I mean, I knew what Emmys were, but what do you mean we got to do a thing? Well, we got to pick episodes and we got to, and I go, I can't even look at it. I'm not going to pick, you pick it.
Right.
And so I think Tommy ended up picking them. This episode would never win an Emmy these days.
You don't think so?
Not even close. No way. No chance.
Why?
No
chance. Why do you
chance.
Think that?
Why? Because nowadays you have to act the shit out of it.
Chew the scenery?
Way too subtle. Like I was looking at it going, are people, even yesterday, it was like, are people getting this? Did they get that? Because I know I felt it, but did they get that? Because, and nowadays, I mean, look at the stuff, with the material also that's written calls for that. I mean, whether it's even Breaking Bad, I mean, it's Shakespearean, it's larger than life, it's crazy, and Game of Thrones. I don't know who's winning Emmy these days. I don't really know. But I'm guessing how people have to wave two hands, jump up and down,
look
get naked, and then slit somebody's throat just to get people to look at you, And I can't imagine that this would even be nominated nowadays. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
I think you're wrong, too. The last thing I wanted to say about that Emmy moment is, on your way down to accept, you gave John Spencer a hug, and he was also nominated that year. And that exchange.
And Brad wasn't nominated that year.
He didn't deserve
just the two
it,
of you from,
really.
From
he wasn't that good.
He really wasn't. Just that, and his hair was weird.
That hasn't changed.
It's gray now. Did you see him gray? He's very gray now.
Yes, he plays, I think he plays LBJ's grandfather in that upcoming HBO film.
Is this true?
He's in it. I assume he plays old Pappy Johnson.
Well, I was trying to point out a nice moment, but that's...
Well, what was the moment?
Oh, just the hug that you guys had was really...
John
really
was a very special very special man, and we were all ecstatic when he won.
Right.
And we were nominated the year he won, and we were literally, he should win.
Right.
I remember interrupting him when we were all interviewed afterwards, because I think we won Best Show as well, and we, you know, you go through this press thing afterwards, and the kind of silly person, Entertainment Tonight or Hollywood, whatever, was asking him, how does it feel to win an Emmy? Which is kind of like saying, how does it feel to be the best? And John started stumbling, and I just said, John, shut up. And I just started speaking about what an incredibly generous, thorough, spectacular actor he's been over decades. And I think I expressed for everyone how we felt about him. He, you know, I think at first there was a little bit of rubbing the wrong way between us. I think there was some...
Oh, really?
Not in a significant way, but I think there... You know, John Spencer walked around like, who's the character with the dust and peanuts?
Pigpen.
Pigpen.
He walked around like Pigpen.
I buzzed in first. Pigpen. Yeah.
But the dust bowl around John Spencer were the many, many demons he carries with him. And what's phenomenal about all the work that, the incredible work that he did in his career, was that he would find these demons and put them to use for his work. But they took over his life a few times. You know, he had got into some trouble it was dealt with on the show, mm-hmm. with alcohol and with other things. And at that point in his life, the demons were in check. And he was, as fiercely as someone dives into the world of abuse of substances, is as fiercely as he dived into the feeling of love for his fellow actors and for the people he respected. And I remember writing for his memorial, he would come at you like Joe Frazier going at Muhammad Ali, you know, low, and he'd smack you with compliments. Oh my God, did you see, like on Thursday morning, you were, you know, with that moment you had, blah, 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 and he'd just come at you. And really close to your face. And I remember that because there were some projectiles every now and then. And he landed a left hook and he would just melt you down. He'd just buckle your knees with this incredible enthusiasm for what you brought to the table and this love. He loved every single aspect of acting. He loved, he was a great theater actor as well. He loved the dressing rooms. He loved the trailers. He loved the makeup. He'd show up in the makeup in the morning. He would show up about 3 hours early and just lie back in his makeup chair, and he'd have two little iPads, you know, and he'd be in his robe and his slippers, and he would just gossip with the makeup people, you know, for 2 or 3 hours, you know, and he had thick makeup on. He just loved the whole thing. And so that hug was part of that intense love that he had for me and that I had for him that early. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
He was freaking amazing.
Yeah, he was a special person.
And how great is Allison in every episode? I saw the pilot and I saw her in this. In this episode, she was with Dan. She had the thing with Danny, right? Mm-hmm. And the fish, and she finally says yes to the date.
We should note, because we want to continue doing this, starting with this episode, Gail, the goldfish's fishbowl, has a topical ornament, and in this episode, it's a Christmas tree. But this is the first time.
Well, that was important. I'm glad we brought it up.
Very important. This is the kind of thing we try to obsess about, Richard.
I was going to say at some point, you know, when I heard one of your podcasts, because you sent me the thing, and I went, these guys should get a life.
We're going to again. True. In about three years, we'll get a life again. Until then.
How long are you going to be doing this for?
As long as people will listen, we plan to get through every episode. So that means that you have to come back multiple times. But you'll come back, right? You'll do this with other episodes, right?
Yeah. I wanted.
That sounded tentative. Can we take that again?
No, it's not tentative. I just don't know if I'm going to be alive by Thursday. But yeah, I'd be happy. All doubt comes from the fact that I could be dead soon.
Is there something we don't know, or that's just your take on life?
It's the nature of existential strife.
Fair enough.
But yes, we're
very similar, I think, you and I.
I think we're similar. We just have, it comes out differently.
Yeah, perhaps.
But it might be from the same fire, the same little source.
That might be the case.
So next week, after this episode, we're actually going to take a little bit of a break from recapping. We're going to pause on In Excelsis Deo and sort of stay with the episode. We're going to be talking to Melissa Fitzgerald.
She's the only one of us that has become the real thing and is the national director of Justice for Vets, the great work that they're doing, keeping vets out of jail and rehabbing and all that stuff.
We're going to take the week off, and instead, on Memorial Day, a few days early, we're going to put out our interview with Melissa Fitzgerald, talking about both her role as Carol and then also her role in Justice for Vets.
And talk about the fact that she has not aged one single nanosecond.
I feel like she and I are the two that just
No, that's not quite accurate. She is as beautiful and as lovely a spirit as she was back then, which is quite remarkable.
Thanks so much for joining us. In the meantime, if you have comments or questions, you can discuss this episode with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly, or on our website, thewestwingweekly.com.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next? No, that was awful. Let's do that again.
He wants to do more.
Do it again. Okay.
Another take, please.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.